Today is July the 14th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank at pcradioshow.org. Thirty-six states and the District of Columbia accuse Google of violating antitrust laws. At least 36 U.S. states and Washington, D.C. have filed a lawsuit against Google alleging that it controls over Android App Store violates antitrust laws. The lawsuit alleges Google has not allowed Android to serve as an open source for many years, effectively cutting off potential competition. The lawsuit alleges that through a series of exclusionary contracts and other anti-competitive conduct in the Google Play Store, Google has deprived Android device users of robust competition that could lead to greater choice and innovation, as well as significantly lower prices for mobile apps. The New York Attorney General and the coalition, co-led by the attorney generals from Utah, North Carolina, and Tennessee, also accused Google of requiring app developers selling in-app digital content through apps purchased via Google's Play Store to use Google Billing as a middleman, forcing app consumers to pay Google's commission up to 30% indefinitely. The New York Attorney General alleges Google has served as the gatekeeper of the Internet for many years, but more recently it has also become the gatekeeper of our digital devices, resulting in all of us paying more for the software we use every day. Once again, we are seeing Google use its dominance to illegally quash competition and profit to the tune of billions. Through its illegal conduct, the company has ensured that hundreds of millions of Android users turn to Google and only Google for the millions of applications they may choose to download to their phones and tablets. Worse yet, Google is squeezing the lifeblood out of millions of small businesses that are only seeking to compete. We are filing this lawsuit to end Google's illegal monopoly power and finally give voice to millions of consumers and business owners. The lawsuit alleges that Google imposes technical barriers that strongly discourage or completely prevent third-party app developers from distributing apps outside of the Google Play Store. Specifically, Google builds into Android a series of misleading security warnings and other barriers that discourage users from downloading apps from any source outside of Google's Play Store, effectively foreclosing app developers and app stores from direct distribution to consumers. Google has not allowed Android to serve as an open source for many years, effectively cutting off potential competition. Google forces OEMs that wish to design their device to use Android to enter into agreements called Android Compatibility Commitments, or ACCs. Under these take-it-or-leave-it agreements, OEMs must promise not to create or implement any variants or versions of Android that deviate from the Google-certified version of Android, the lawsuit alleges. The lawsuit also alleges that Google buys off its potential competition in the market for app distribution. Google forces app developers and app users alike to use Google Payment Processing Service, the Google Play Billing, to process any payments for purchases of digital content made in apps obtained through the Google Play Store. Thus, Google is unlawfully tying the use of Google Payment Processor, which is a separate service within a separate market for payment processing within apps, to distribution through the Google Play Store. By forcing this tie, Google is able to extract an exorbitant processing fee for each transaction as high as 30% and many times higher than payment processing fees charged in competitive markets. Late breaking news on Chromebooks. Do not install the latest Chromebook update. Google has pulled the latest Chromebook update amid slowdowns. Reports have been emerging that some Chromebook owners are experiencing significant performance regressions with the update to 91.0.4472.147. However, in the process of pausing the update on devices, Google has introduced another problem. You can no longer install Linux on what has now become the latest release again, version 91.0.4472.114. That is, Google is now pointing to this version as the most recent stable release. If you've already got Linux up and running, you should be good to go. But it is advised you not do power wash or otherwise reset your Chromebook until Google has figured out and resolved this problem. The original problem with version 91.0.4472.147 massively slowed down some Chromebooks immediately after installation, with some owners reporting that even power washing and disabling all extensions didn't fix the problem at all. Some process is locking up the CPU, resulting in unusually high processor usage at 100% for some. At least it looks like not all Chromebooks were affected by the issue. Hopefully Google can resolve this issue as quickly as possible. So you haven't gotten the latest word, do not install the latest Chromebook update. Microsoft issues urgent security warning. Update your PC immediately. Microsoft is urging Windows users to immediately install an update after security researchers found a serious vulnerability in the operating system. Affects the Windows principle of service. Researchers at cybersecurity company Sangfor, they accidentally published a how-to guide for exploiting it. The researchers tweeted in late May that they had found vulnerabilities in Printspooler, which allows multiple users to access a printer. They published a proof of concept online by mistake and subsequently deleted it, but not before it was published elsewhere online, including developer site GitHub. Microsoft warned that hackers that exploit the vulnerability could install programs, view and delete data, or even create new user accounts with full user rights. That gives hackers enough command and control of your PC to do very serious damage. Windows 10 is not the only version affected. Windows 7, which Microsoft has ended support for last year, is also subject to the same vulnerability. Despite announcing that it would no longer issue updates for Windows 7, Microsoft issued a patch for its 12-year-old operating system, underscoring the severity of the print nightmare flaw. Updates for Windows Server 2016, Windows 10 version 1607, and Windows Server 2012 expected soon, it said. They recommend that you install these updates immediately. If there's any good news, is that the current security update is cumulative, meaning it contains previous fixes for previous security issues too. It's the latest in a slew of security alerts from Microsoft in the past year and a half. The company has been embroiled in safety issues, including in 2020 when the National Security Agency alerted Microsoft to a major flaw in its Windows operating system that could let hackers pose as legitimate software companies. And this year, hundreds of thousands of Exchange users were targeted after four vulnerabilities in its software allowed hackers to access servers for the popular email and calendar service. Microsoft was also the target of a devastating SolarWinds breach. Notably, Microsoft hasn't released a patch for Windows 11. Its newest operating system, due out soon, is currently available for beta testers. Windows 11 comes 6 years after Microsoft last overhauled its operating system with Windows 10, a major update that's now running on around 1.3 billion devices worldwide. Some AMD laptops reduce system performance for better battery life. AMD isn't wrong for reducing laptop performance for better battery life, but the industry needs to be more honest about the practice. There are a few examples as inspiring as AMD when it comes to tech media. A formerly written-off company is now making a powerful comeback. Taking on the lumbering old Intel, AMD seemingly can do no wrong as the underdog. Not only is it a great tale, but it is also good for the industry, thanks to increased competition. But putting aside the hyperbolic fan bases from both camps, and AMD does have some odd behavior found in laptops. I'm not sure it's the wrong approach, but it's a very different one from Intel's. The issue at hand is a significant reduction in performance across the board. CPU, GPU, and even the SSD, when using the laptop's battery compared to being plugged into a wall, whereas Intel systems, by comparison, don't do this at all. When plugged into the wall for power, that's a AC outlet itself, modern AMD laptops are powerful machines, obliterating most Intel laptops thanks to their multi-core advantage. Intel still pulls ahead on single-core performance, however, for what it's worth. AMD is so good that it can rival Apple's M1 CPU, even passing it on multi-core performance. AMD laptops also get commendable battery life. It is not mind-blowing good from that perspective. The narrative is AMD laptops get much better performance and excellent battery life. So why go with Intel? The trouble with that narrative is that many AMD laptops achieve their battery life because when not on AC, the performance of the CPU, GPU, and even the SSD is dramatically slowed down. Now, imagine battery life if the AMD system performance wasn't reduced. AMD would like to prolong battery life, which is an admirable goal, but the SSD performance drop is due to their PSPP, that's the PCI Express speed power policy, set by AMD and is not something that it can be controlled. I assume something similar is happening with the CPU and GPU too. But is AMD wrong in doing this? AMD is trying to find a balance between performance and battery life, and its strategy makes sense when you think about how people use laptops. I've known quite a few video editors in my life, and they all work plugged in, which is likely the same for gamers. When you want to do serious work, you find a power outlet, and that assumption is valid for most users. Intel takes a differing approach to modern computing. Newer 10th and 11th generation laptops barely budge in performance regardless of the power state, AC or DC. There are two issues with AMD that needs to be addressed. Consumer education. When you buy a laptop with AMD, do you know the system performance may be degraded when on battery? And the second is, why is there no overrides for this behavior? The first one is on laptop makers to be honest about how these chips work. Most reviewers plug in the laptop, set it to maximum performance, run some benchmarks, and call it a day. It is rare to run a suite of benchmarks on battery because, historically, there has been a negligible difference, but that has now changed with AMD and many reviewers don't realize this. The second item is more baffling. Microsoft built a robust slider mechanism into Windows 10 for controlling battery and performance. Battery Saver reduces performance and dims the screen. Recommended tries to balance everything for most users. Better performance favors the CPU and GPU, and best performance lets everything fly. Microsoft wants you to pick the power mode you need at the moment. But while Intel has this system in place, some AMD laptops do not follow it, at least not like Intel. Best performance and your processor and SSD will slightly increase performance, but to a degree that is still miles behind best performance when on AC. You want to flick a switch to get the same performance on AC and DC? Sorry, on AMD it does not exist. At the very least, AMD should let users push the system as hard as it can. Battery life be damned. Why is AMD given a pass on this information in the press? Turning the tables, imagine if Intel was bragging about the improved battery life in its processors, only to have it revealed that it achieves this by nearly halving the system's performance, even the SSD. When not plugged in, AMD fans would be frothing at the mouth on how stupid Intel was. Tech headlines would be trashing the company, and it would be a public relation nightmare with Intel being accused of cheating. But when AMD does it, it's no big deal. Go Team Red. Now, all this, PC World did an excellent analysis of this topic, and they provided a ton of data on this. But as a reviewer, my problem is this adds a new wrinkle in explaining system performance, which is already highly complicated. Do we need to report a laptop's performance both on AC and DC now? Will audiences understand why setting to max performance is not max performance if you're not plugged into the war? And does anyone even care? So who is better, Intel or AMD? It is a rhetorical question, as both companies are doing some exceptional work in the processor space. What is also becoming clear is AMD is forging its own path on how it thinks laptops should operate, and it differs from Intel. That's all fine. While I'm not against the idea of reducing system performance or increased battery life, I am not sure why AMD needs to ignore the system performance slider found in the Windows 10 operating system. It does not look good, even if the intention behind it is. Do you think AMD's approach is the right one? Does it impact your thoughts on buying a new laptop? Should we even bother talking about DC performance differences in the notebooks? Should Intel cut its performance on DC too? We'd like to be able to measure AMD and Intel on the same level ground of criteria, not where one can pick and choose and game the system on how people review their products. Employees at Google are getting in a tizzy over opaque policies on remote work. As Google employees around the world make plans for post-pandemic return to work at the tech giant, Google's attempt to get its employees after a year of remote work back into the office has been marked by indecision and backpedaling. Last fall, a team was told that it would need to relocate to North Carolina from the company's office in Sunnydale, California, about 40 miles south of San Francisco. The prospect of ditching Bay Area housing prices and long commutes was a powerful draw. The move, however, came with a 15% salary cut. Then in late March, the team was told it would be a 25% cut. And a month after that, the team relocation plans were scrapped altogether. Though remote work is sweeping corporate America, Google has been reluctant to let any employees do it permanently, which is an approach Twitter and Reddit have taken. Google isn't the only tech company wrestling with its workforce, increasing desire for flexibility. Apple is facing its own backlash from employees, while Facebook just extended remote work options to all its employees. But the way the search giant has handled the rollout of its plan has drawn particular scrutiny. In May, CEO Sundar Pichai unveiled plans for a hybrid work environment that would require most employees to work from their offices at least 3 days a week beginning in September. Under the new structure, 20% of the company would work remotely. Another 20% could work from new locations. People who relocated would get salary adjustments based on the local market. The bulk of Google would pick up where it left off, working from the office. Google makes up almost all of Alphabet, a holding company that has more than 135,000 full-time employees. As the company sorts out who will work where and how much they'll be paid, Google employees say tension has broken out over office transfers, compensation adjustments, and remote work. The competition for transfers and the prospect of pay cuts has provoked growing anger. The dust-up over the future of the company's workplace policies has the potential to affect every person at the tech giant. The agitation over remote work policies has provided a new source of friction for a company whose employees are already well experienced in rebelling against leadership. Workers have protested Google's handling of sexual misconduct, its work in China, and the ousting of researchers who criticize the company's artificial intelligence systems. What happens at Google doesn't necessarily stay at Google. For more than two decades, the search giant has set the tone for office culture in Silicon Valley, pioneering lavish employee perks like free food and gym service. The impact of Google's remote work policies could ripple far and wide as other companies look to the tech giant as a guide. Google plays a very key role in the industry. Certain organizations may be inspired by actions that Google's taking. Google employees now undergoing the remote work application process has been told decisions won't come until August, at the earliest. A Google spokesman declined to comment but said, "Every employee is eligible to request remote work, regardless of their group or department." Google's stance on salaries has drawn blowback within the tech giant, while some tech companies like Reddit have said they'll pay employees San Francisco or New York City salaries wherever they work. Google has taken a hard line on making pay adjustments. Last month, Google released an internal tool that gives employees estimates of how their salaries would be affected if they relocated. The remote work policies have taken a toll on the people around Google workers. Some employees have speculated about Google's motivations for emphasizing in-person work. Google has major real estate investment in its corporate hubs, including some still in development. A workforce sprawled around the globe make those investments less useful. In May, San Jose, California, approved plans for an 80-acre Google campus that will include office space, housing, and retail. For a company whose identity is in part associated with extravagant corporate facilities and whimsical culture, the stringent policies regarding office transfers and salary adjustments may be a way to nudge employees into staying put. Employees say one of the most difficult parts of Google's return to office system is the inability to plan for a future with their loved ones. Google has been vague and unhelpful about the process for most of the year, and as what one employee said, the confusion has meant workers have had to leave crucial decisions like schooling for children and apartment leases up in the air. Using the Google search engine, would one expect that you get the same search results if queried in different locations in the world? Search Atlas did just that to determine if Google's search algorithm is weighted to show different results depending on your location. In other words, would you get the same result objectivity from the search engine? At least you hope that Google is not biased and has a finger on the scale. Search Atlas did just that recently. They used a tool that shows how results for sensitive topics like political conflicts or even just the word God can differ significantly across regions. If that is the case, and it was, Google should be completely open as to what factors affect a Google search. How does a search engine like Google quantify, analyze, and rank information? What factors does it take into account, and how are they weighted? The algorithms that handle queries may be opaque, but the end results are clearly visible. That's the idea behind Search Atlas, a new tool developed that aims to show how Google would display search results if a query was entered from different locales around the world. The computer publication Wired reported that the creators of Search Atlas first presented their results at the Designing Interactive Systems Conference in June, and it remains in private beta, but they have released a paper and other preview materials on the project's website. That tool is already turning up interesting results. For example, using Search Atlas to look for the images of God turns up Christian imagery in the United States and Europe, while in Russia it turned up images of Buddha, and in the Persian Gulf and North America it turned up with Arabic script. In the UK and Singapore, a search for Tiananmen Square turned up images related to the massacre, while a search tuned to China, where Google has been blocked since 2010, turned up recent sunny images of the square smattered with tourists. Well, I think you might expect that. Results for how to combat climate change emphasized policy solutions in Germany, while island nations like Mauritius and the Philippines seem to receive results emphasizing the immediate dire nature of the threat, like sea level rise that threatens to disproportionately impact them much sooner. Similarly, Wired wrote that queries on the war in Ethiopia, Tigray's region set to within the country, turned up Facebook pages and blogs that criticized Western diplomatic pressure to de-escalate the conflict, suggesting that the United States and others were trying to weaken Ethiopia. Whereas searches set to Kenya or the United States more prominently feature explanatory news coverages from sources such as the BBC and the New York Times. MIT Science, Technology and Society PhD student and Search Atlas creator told Wired that the project aims to dispel the persistent notion that search engines like Google are neutral arbitrators of information. Any attempt to quantify relevance necessarily encodes moral and political priorities. A computer science PhD student at Carnegie Mellon University and research fellow at the Center for Arts, Design, and Social Research nonprofit told Wired that people ask search engines things they would never ask a person, and the things they happen to see in Google's results can change their lives. It could be, how do I get an abortion, a restaurant near you, or how you vote, or get a vaccine. For example, Google results for Crimean annexation showed up results in Russia framed around the impact on the Russian Federation, in Ukraine framed around occupation, and in the Netherlands framed around European Union sanctions on Russia. These disparate results aren't necessarily the result of any intent to suppress information, but factors like Google trying to localize its results to be, well, more interest to people in specific geographic regions, commercial interests, and local laws. These supposedly apolitical adjustments nonetheless inevitably bleeds over into politics. While the difference in results for Tiananmen Square appears to reflect the Chinese government's desire to cover up the incident, a Google spokesperson told Wire that the search engine turns up the tourist-friendly images when it infers an intent to travel. The differences in search for God, the spokesperson told the site, were due to the way the term is translated into different languages. The end result is a partial slice of reality predicated upon Google's assumption about the world and influenced by a desire to maximize revenue. Well, for most of us, that's what we can conclude. Even the earliest studies based on anecdotal observations already suggested that search engines systematically suppress some sites in favor of others, in line with financial interests. The researchers wrote in the paper, more recent studies have argued that commercial search engines deploy algorithms that reinforce existing social structures, particularly racist and sexist patterns of exposure, invisibility, and marginalization. Thus, it is vital to expose the partial perspective of search engines. Amen. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. Don't share passwords.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. It's time for us to discuss the workplace and some of the many things that we do these days. It was only recently that the largest hack yet, some 8 billion passwords, were attached to a text document. And we think, wow, all of that. And you know what? I'm not sharing my passwords out there. I'm just sharing them with Jane at the office. This is not good. Our passwords truly are out there. And they're going to continue to be out there. And we need to change our passwords on a regular basis. Always. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Change your password. If you think somebody has your password, you change it. And this is all of your passwords. Do this on a regular basis. And you can base your passwords off of different SALT items. So SALT term is your basic, and then you alter it up in a number of different ways based on where that password is being used. And we'll use just as SALT. I'll use the word SALT. And then I may say SALT dot, you use a period, because that's usable in many passwords, work, and then put in a number that's associated with that. And then you salt dot Amazon and then a number, and then salt dot Yahoo and then a number, salt dot Google and a number, whatever it is. But you want to make sure that you're changing this all up as best you can. You want a different password in all of these different locations. See, here's the problem with sharing your passwords, though, and this is actually more of what I wanted to talk about, and that is, these days, people share their passwords with a coworker. This is a frequent situation. I do not. I have not done that. Let's see here. The last time I did it was when I was... No, actually, I was at a different, like 500 miles away, and I had tech go into the office, but I had already set up an admin account for him as my backup. So that was some 5, 6, 7 years ago, and I haven't shared my password since, but I know people do. Here's the problem. You say that Jane is the only person who knows your password. Well, let's face it, once Jane knows your work password, Jane knows your Amazon password. Well, maybe not the Amazon password, but she may have a good idea. Or maybe it's a matter of it's the Google password. Maybe it's not related. Maybe you've got a different password there. But even still, once Jane knows your password, there's at least one more person who knows the password other than you. Now, who's going to get into trouble if Jane uses your password improperly? It's not going to be Jane. I assure you, because you can't step up and say, oh, Jane has my password. Maybe she did it, because that's only going to open up more problems. And what's going to happen is, yes, you and Jane are both going to lose their job if it's really bad. Do you honestly trust Jane with your job? And I want you to think about this very carefully. I don't know how much you're getting made, but I will tell you, being on the unemployment line, you don't want to be there. So do you trust Jane for the idea of you being unemployed for the next 3 months, 6 months, a year? The answer is no. I mean, well, maybe you do. Maybe you trust Jane with your life, with your financial security, with your future, with your 401k and all of that. I don't. And what about Jack? I mean, Jane was away from her desk. She said, you know what? You can go on and you can use Benjamin's password. It's XYZ123. Now, Jack knows your password as well as Jane. Or maybe Jane's sitting there, she's trying to log in, and Stuart comes along and he's helpful, and she's going, hey, I'm trying to log in with Benjamin's password. Stuart, can you help me with this? And Stuart goes, sure, let's try that. What is Benjamin's password? Oh yeah, here we go. Look, beyond this, what secrets do you have on the network? Now, and I'm not talking your own personal secrets, although they could exist there, but what secrets are sitting there on your computer that the company considers secrets that Jane does not have access to. You know, Jane's a great receptionist, but I wouldn't trust her with, you know, access to our financials. And you're the CFO and you give Jane the password. That's not good. She now has access to those financials. Now, maybe she couldn't make sense out of it. Maybe, you know, maybe all these other things, but this is already not good. But I'm going to throw one more item at you. Jane gets a call and it sounds like you, or she gets a text message. It's a spoofed text message and she thinks it's you. And you're going along in this call or this text message or this email or whatever, and you need access to a particular file. And just email it to this Google address, if you would, Jane. So I've got access from home. You know, this is how some of the social engineers work, to get access to the content within your network. Do you trust Jane with your work life, with your financial security? My best answer for you to say is no. Don't share your password. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. When it comes to car vehicle maintenance, there is the regular oil change. This only goes so far in keeping your vehicle in tip-top shape. To ensure vehicle safety, most but not all states mandate annual car inspection. Investing the time and money into a car inspection is a proactive step in reducing your chances of breaking down. Knowing your vehicle is running smoothly offers you peace of mind. Many car issues build up over time. This means they can be caught and fixed before they cause big trouble. But these little fixable problems aren't always easily detectable. A vehicle inspection by an experienced and certified technician can help catch them long before they result in a lapse in function. Identifying small issues before they become problems will save you time and money in the long run. Car inspections are considered preventive maintenance. And then there's also what we call the annual physical health examination. It is highly recommended that everyone, regardless of age, have an annual physical exam done every single year. Physical exams are typically performed by your primary care physician. A physical examination can be helpful because it can help determine the status of your health. This can give way to early intervention and prevention of any health issues that you are currently at risk for. Moreover, it can help you have an open communications with your doctor and give you an opportunity to share information about your symptoms and overall health. These exams are also used to update immunization and check for possible ailments so that they can be diagnosed and treated before symptoms even appear. Why is physical examination important? People visit their doctors only when they are sick and need treatment. For some people, this may be every few months, or for others, well, maybe once every few years when something happens. An annual physical exam lets you and your doctor assess how you are doing health-wise, regardless of whether you're feeling symptoms or not. It can also help you determine if any area of your health needs attention so they don't cause bigger issues later on. Similarly, we should be adopting preventive maintenance for your computing system. Preventive maintenance, often called PM in the computer field, is the regular and routine maintenance of equipment and assets in order to keep them running and prevent any costly unplanned downtime from unexpected equipment failure. A successful maintenance strategy requires planning and scheduling maintenance of equipment before a problem occurs. A good preventive maintenance plan also involves keeping record of past inspections and the servicing of equipment. Because of the complexity of maintaining a preventive maintenance schedule for a large amount of equipment, many companies use preventive maintenance software to organize their required preventive maintenance tasks. So, what are the types of preventive maintenance? PM is used to anticipate and prevent the breakdown of equipment and should ideally be performed on all items of equipment to prevent age-related failure. Manufacturers often provide recommendations to maintain a piece of equipment. But, generally speaking, there are three main types of preventive maintenance tasks. There's the mandatory and the non-mandatory task. Mandatory tasks are those that must be performed as soon as they are due and will often include safety critical checks. Non-mandatory tasks are still important, but can be delayed without resulting in a critical failure or performance reduction. A preventive maintenance checklist should split these tasks into mandatory and non-mandatory. Then there's pyramiding and non-pyramiding tasks. Pyramiding task occurs when maintenance is set for a due date, but is not completed and overlaps with a later scheduled maintenance. In this instance, should a new PM task become due, the previous one is canceled, and a cancellation should include a note to explain this, and a new task should include the original due date to monitor how overdue the task is. Some companies prefer a non-pyramiding structure, which removes the need to note the original missed task and just takes the new date as the baseline. And then there's inspection and task-oriented task. Inspection tasks require checks to be made before the results are turned into work orders for planned maintenance to fix any problems that have been discovered. Task-oriented PMs allow for minor repairs and adjustments to be made at the time of inspection, reducing the amount of work that needs to be written up as work orders on the inspection sheet. When is preventive maintenance required? Well, the exact requirement for preventive maintenance will vary depending on the equipment and the operation it is performing. Industry uses standards to help determine schedules for maintenance so that assets do not run to failure. These guidelines will also cover the type of inspection or maintenance that is needed. Ideally, by following guidelines set down by manufacturers or standards, a PM schedule should ensure proactive maintenance rather than having to resort to reactive maintenance when something has already begun to fail. Following this type of predictive maintenance schedule through tasks such as conditioning, monitoring, requires accurate recording of inspection and servicing against an understanding of the lifespan of a particular piece of equipment. These records will help determine when preventive maintenance is required. Now, there are hardware diagnostics that read out the performance of your hardware. Such a program I use is HW Info64. There are other diagnostics that you can use. For me, HW Info64 is a simple application that scans your PC's components and splits out basic computer information about your operating system, storage capacity, and RAM. It also displays more tech-centric data, such as the number of logical CPUs, memory speed, and battery wear level. It will detail the condition of your laptop battery, and it will read out the speed of the fan. By the way, the fan in the computer may be functioning, but over time, the accumulation of dust will start slowing it down. If unattended, the fan will reach a critical point when it is not working properly. This can result in overheating and the system running slower, and you're not even aware of it, or you know it's just running slow and you don't know what the cause is. This, by the way, is most prevalent for those who have cats and dogs as pets. Their hair gets into the fan. If you need to use your laptop system in portable mode, you may find that the wear factor on the battery has a very short battery uptime. There is also the software side to preventive maintenance. When the operating system storage device space is more than 75% filled, the available space for virtual paging decreases. This results in the operating system running slower due to available temporary storage, resulting in an increase for more frequent virtual paging. Review periodically what applications have been installed on your system. Unwanted bloatware often sneaks in with social engineering when you're not aware of it. Review what tasks are activated on startup. Most installed applications assume you want the application to be active on initial system boot. Rather than guessing what I will be doing with the system, I minimize applications at startup. When I need an app, they are then loaded and activated when invoked. Having idle applications activated in startup mode robs you of RAM storage right at the outset. There are utility programs to help you identify what is in the startup process. I use a program called IOBit. During the day, when I take a break, I just restart the system to clear out the buildup in unwanted standby apps. My preventive maintenance also includes a review of what information I have downloaded and is no longer needed. I get a lot of email with attachments, and I may have deleted the message, but the attached file is still sitting in the download directory. An often overlooked part of preventive maintenance is reviewing archival material such as audio, video, and digital files that have been stored onto long-term storage media. As installed equipment evolves on your system, you may want to begin and continue the process of transferring that information from the legacy media to more readily available storage. Hopefully, all of us are doing regular backups. This process, when done daily, is like clockwork, but take the time out to periodically go through the refresh process of doing a data recovery. This is like running an annual fire drill to refresh what steps to take when needed. Add to the preventive maintenance process the review of what information you have accumulated. Don't be an addicted hoarder of every past email, article, and other media materials saved for future reference. You'll find that almost all of that saved data haven't been referenced after the initial save. Then you may have extra pieces of equipment that's no longer needed, but it's taking up space. And this is probably one of the more emotional tasks to undertake. It is because of the initial cost of the equipment. After the pandemic fades away, I will finally get rid of all that equipment I haven't touched in years because I'm not planning on establishing a museum. So take stock of all your computing wares and set up a preventive maintenance schedule. You may want certain tasks to be done monthly, some quarterly, and the dreaded task maybe at least once a year. Well, Minecraft is now R-rated. Yes, R-rated in South Korea. Well, what do you need to know about Minecraft? What is it? Minecraft is a video game in which players create and break apart various kinds of blocks in three-dimensional worlds. The game's two main nodes are survival and creative. In survival mode, players must find their own building supplies and food. They also interact with block-like mobs or moving creatures. Creepers and zombies are some of the dangerous ones. In creative mode, players are given supplies and do not have to eat to survive. They also can break all kinds of blocks immediately. Minecraft is a sandbox video game developed by the Swedish video game developer Mojang Studios. It was first made public in May of 2009, before fully releasing in November of 2011. Minecraft has since been ported to several other platforms and is the best-selling video game of all time, with over 200 million copies sold and 126 million monthly active users as of 2020. In Minecraft, players explore a blocky, procedurally generated 3D world with virtually infinite terrain and may discover and extract raw materials, craft tools and items, and build structures or earthworks, depending on game mode. Players can fight computer-controlled mobs as well as cooperate with or compete against other players in the same world. Game modes include a survival mode in which players must acquire resources to build the world and maintain health, and a creative mode where players have unlimited resources. Players can modify the game to create new gameplay mechanics, items, and assets. Minecraft has been critically acclaimed, winning several awards and being cited as one of the greatest video games of all time. Social media, parodies, adaptations, merchandise, and the annual MineCon conventions play large roles in popularizing the game. It has also been used in educational environments, especially in the realm of computing systems, as virtual computers and hardware devices have been built in it. In 2014, Mojang and Minecraft intellectual properties were purchased by Microsoft for $2.5 billion. A number of spin-off games have also been produced, such as Minecraft Story Mode, Minecraft Dungeons, and Minecraft Earth. Minecraft accounts were the first way to log into Minecraft on a computer, and Mojang accounts were later introduced as a single account to use across all Mojang games. Microsoft accounts became the new account type for all purchases of Minecraft, Java edition after December 1, 2020. Incredibly, the government of Korea has slapped an adults-only age rating in South Korea. Originally, the bizarre restriction comes down to the country's Cinderella law, which pulls the plug on any child or teen hoping to play games with their mates into the early hours of the morning. The law has been in place since 2011 and means anyone under the age of 16 is prohibited from playing online video games between midnight and 6 a.m. Instead of bothering to implement any form of after-hours screening to Xbox Live or separate servers, Microsoft instead changed their policy for South Korea in 2012. So anybody wanting to make an account has to be at least 19 years old. This hasn't impacted Minecraft so far, as the game's still been allowing players to sign in with their Mojang account, which doesn't require age verification. Well, that's changed now, with the official Minecraft website warning players back in December 2020 that they need to start signing in with Xbox Live account to access the game. The migration started off a voluntary thing, but then in March, an additional warning popped up specifically for South Korea, informing that anyone looking to buy the game would need to be at least 19 years old. So while Minecraft currently sits at a 12-plus age rating through the country, game rating, and administration committee, the mandatory Xbox Live sign-in bumps that straight up to 18-plus rating. Understandably, many Korean players are pretty ticked off about the whole thing. A petition on the government's official website has accrued over 88,000 signatures, asking for South Korea to get rid of the Cinderella law and its inadvertent restriction on Minecraft. The law finally stretched out to Minecraft, which is regarded as the epitome of educational and creative games. A machine translation of the petition reads, "Korea will become the only game market where even Minecraft is reduced to an adult game." The petition goes on to claim that the curfew law is unnecessary and disregards the benefits games can have on youngsters. Also, you know, how easy a law can apparently be to circumvent. Microsoft is yet to respond with a comment about the situation. On a more positive note on Minecraft news, a super rare version of the game that was up for less than 4 hours was recently discovered on Twitter using dusty old hard drive. A Microsoft spokesperson responded, "We are proceeding with the global migration of Mojang accounts to Microsoft accounts for Minecraft, Java Edition, including for our players in South Korea. We're working on a longer-term solution for existing and new players under the age of 19 in South Korea, and we'll have more to share on this matter later this year." South Korea, you're becoming a controlling state. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, July the 22nd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is bcug.com. The Westchester PC User Group meets Thursday, August the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, August the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi, that's J-I-T-S-I, and their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 12th, 2021 at 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom. The website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, August the 13th, 2021 at 7 p.m. It's an online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. podcast of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.